Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy.
Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today, a repeat guest, one that I'm really looking forward to speaking to again, Dan Abrahams. Good afternoon, Dan. How are you, man?
Yes, I'm very well. Honoured, delighted to be here with you. So good to be speaking.
Awesome. Dan, just conscious, obviously, you know, you've been on the show a couple of times, but there's probably some people that haven't come across the episodes or new people coming to the show still. So just maybe a brief insight around who you are, what you do, and we'll go for it from there.
Sure. Dan Abrahams. I'm a sports psychologist. I've got 28 years in high performance sport, 18 years now as a qualified and registered sports psychologist here in the UK, but working globally. I work across all sports. I mean, I have a competitive background myself. I was a professional golfer and then a golf coach. So I have a playing and coaching background. But as a sports psychologist, I've worked across all sports. But principally work in football. So I've worked at about half a dozen Premier League clubs, Championship clubs, up and down the pyramid. Worked with individuals and coaches around the world. I've got four books, three of them football. One of which, Soccer Tough, Gareth Bale, very kindly a few years ago, said changed his life. Don't think it changed his life, but it was very nice of him to say so. And I suppose just lately, last couple of years, I've been, I was lead psychologist for England Rugby. I'm currently a consultant psychologist with Aston Martin Formula One, and currently in football working with Feyenoord in the Dutch Eredivisie division. So, which has come to prominence in the last couple of weeks with Arne Slot, my boss there, who might maybe seems like he's going to be taking over from Jurgen Klopp. So that's all exciting times for him. So that's me.
Awesome, Dan. There's a wealth of kind of experiences that you've kind of just shared there and given us a bit of insight on. So, you know, within your experience, obviously been around loads of different sports, loads of different coaches, and it really got me thinking. Coming across one of your recent posts around coaches, and you know, you put it across as coaches to be needing to be more greedy. Just, I guess, to help me unpack it and help me get to the kind of the crux of it. Where did those thoughts first start coming from? Was it from a football specific background? Was it just actually as we're starting to observe? In fact, let's take a step further back and ask, what do you mean by coaches need to be more greedy.
Well, thanks. Yes, I can't remember the specific post. I write every day and I post every day, but I think I can imagine where I was coming from there, and it's definitely nothing to do with nutrition either. So I'm a big believer. There's nothing really specific to football, although football is involved. I'm a big believer in coaches, no matter the level that you're coaching at, being as greedy as possible in terms of knowledge, hunger for knowledge, thirst for knowledge, but also being able to deliver on as many topics, subjects as is possible, even in the hour and a half window that you have available to you on the pitch. I think coaches need to be greedy in terms of what they can do during this period. And obviously off the pitch as well, if they have the luxury of being able to communicate and spend time with their players away from training. Not every coach has that. In fact, vast majority of coaches will be recreational coaches, coaches at grassroots, so they have limited time. But even then, I think it is possible. Respecting coaches' time and respecting the fact that, you know, their coaches are going to have families and jobs themselves, just being as greedy as possible in order to deliver as much content as possible, and being able to help players as broadly and as deeply as possible across a range of important disciplines that might be relevant for player engagement, player learning, player performance. So that's what I mean by greedy. And I suppose if I reflect deeply, I mean, obviously so much of my work is at the adult elite level, the professional level, and the development elite level. So please excuse me if I'm coming from slightly from that direction some of the time, although I'd always try to orient towards grassroots and recreational coaches as well. I think historically there's this sort of element of coaches believing that, well, we just deliver on football. And again, I want to challenge that notion very respectfully. I think coaches are in a great position to deliver on psychology. No coaches aren't psychologists per se, although that language has been used historically. But coaches are on the grass are in a great position to develop player psychology in so many ways. And of course, the demands on coaches are vast in terms of more knowledge on speed, agility, quickness, that kind of stuff, strength and conditioning, individual skills development, et cetera, et cetera. So I understand and recognize perhaps it's being very demanding on a coach, but I do think coaches within their own sphere, within their own context, within their own possibilities, given their own demands in life, that can you be as greedy as possible as a coach to get as much knowledge, to build as much knowledge as possible, to distribute that knowledge and to help players learn as much as possible to build their passion for the game. So I suppose that's my long-winded answer to where I'm coming from there.
Well, there's a lot in there, and I think it's a really good way to break it down, because I think it's quite timely for me as well, because I've just had having conversations with coaches recently around, you know, you talked there about the differences of maybe that of a professional coach or coach working in the pro game and that those working in the grassroots game. And I mean, the notion generally is, oh, you want at grassroots football, want to, you know, engage the players, make them fall in love with the game, make them enjoy it. And I guess what happens often in the conversations that I have with coaches at that level is that's what it's all about. And I'm thinking, well, why can't they have that and still be developing? It's not just about making sure that they have fun, because, you know, if it was all about fun, then why not just take them down the road to flip out? Let them jump on a trampoline for a couple hours. I'm sure they'll have fun doing that too. Do you know what I mean? At the end of the day, you're there to coach the players and not just to get them to have fun. And quite often, and it'd be interesting to get your views. I've never met someone who's developed in a process, and not to say they haven't maybe found it challenging at times, but hasn't then resulted in them thinking, you know, actually, that was enjoyable, that was fun, that was a good experience, because they have developed in the process and not just gone for the fun element of it. So, you know, one, what are your thoughts on that aspect of it? And then I guess the second part of, you know, let's start with that, actually.
Yeah, look, I think I share your concern, and I think this is very much and also rather than either or. And I very much promote that lens, that that coaches take, an and also rather than either or approach to most things within coaching, because I don't think, other than bullying and any kind of pernicious ism, I don't think you can discount anything or take anything off the table. Of course, coaches are going to have their own lens of the world, and they're going to want to create their own culture within their own coaching practice, and that's up to them. But I think, as whether it's coach developers, coach educators, or just people who take an interest in talking with coaches about this stuff, I think the challenge needs to be laid down in terms of, you know, being more and also rather than either or. And so to intellectualize that and to build upon what you're saying, you know, you're talking about, I suppose you're using the word fun. I would also use the term enjoyment here. Yes, we want players to enjoy the game, but what is it to enjoy the game? And what is it to create? How do we create lifelong learners? How do we create lifelong participants and lifelong learners? You know, and also we get a bit fixed on this. And reality is, in adulthood, there are going to be many players people who drop out simply because you don't necessarily have the time to be a participant in sport when you've got a family, when you've got work, etc., etc. So, but we certainly want players to love the game, to build a passion for the game, to enjoy playing the game from just a participation perspective with football, but also from a viewership perspective and being involved in the game in the future to introduce others into the game. So let's build on enjoyment here. Well, okay, but also, if we want to have life, if we want to engage people for a long time, we also have to help them get better, potentially. Mm-hmm. It's not just about having fun. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say I can cite this piece of research or that piece of research, but my understanding is that self-efficacy, which is the psychological term for self-belief or self-confidence, plays a part in participation here. You know, well, it's very difficult to build self-confidence without building skills. You know, I think we want to, as coaches, build confidence and competence alongside that basic sense of I'm going to have fun here in order to enjoy playing the game. In fact, we could actually build an equation between us here, perhaps very simplistic equation, a simplistic model of fun plus skills plus confidence, or fun plus competence plus confidence delivered in our sessions equals long-term participation. I think it's thrown into the mix. Sure, we want smiles, absolutely, but we you know, I think players also want sweat and smiles. I think players want to be challenged. I think players want to enjoy winning and, you know, dare I say it, losing. I think players want to learn things. They want to get better. They want to experience a sense of competence. That's what keeps players firmly stuck to the game and coming back for more, in my opinion. So I think it's multi-dimensional. I think the last thing to say here is I think enjoyment and seriousness are not on opposite ends of a single continuum. I think they're on two separate continuums. By that I mean I can enjoy engaging in the game in a serious way. So, you know, I think, you know, we can put those two together and they can coexist. Sure, if we're taking the game really seriously, there's going to be times where the enjoyment levels drop a little bit and it becomes, you know, a bit of hard work. It becomes, you know, really, really challenging and tough. That's okay. That's fine. But I just think enjoyment and seriousness are on different continuums that can be met together in the same coaching practice, in the same coaching culture.
I think it's a really good way to put it. And I think, you know, just it really does just channel in and basically say, look, we can get and or both elements involved in it.
And
right?
And also.
And I think, you know, just kind of building on that. So going back to your initial aspect of being greedy as coaches. Again, another conversation I've been having with a lot of coaches recently around where you still need a strong foundation of technical, maybe tactical understanding of the game. And, you know, the I guess I'm going to phrase it as this, the bite back I sometimes get is, yeah, but that's not what coaching's all about. Which I can agree with to an extent. If you don't have that foundational knowledge from an instructional standpoint, And surely you're limited in what you can or not can and can't offer the players in terms of those that want to go on and develop further or being able to support them maximally. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I agree with you. You know, there's a raft of different approaches, different philosophies, different attitudes within coaching. And I think we have to celebrate that and enjoy that. I don't think there's, as I said to you earlier, I think we take two things off the table, bullying and any kind of pernicious ism, you know, racism, sexism, elitism, et cetera, et cetera. We want those banished. So if we banish those, everything else is on the table. Now, if somebody comes along and says, well, in my coaching at the club that I coach at, my philosophy is this, and that might be autonomy, supportive, giving players the experience of just playing the game, and we're going to be, and as simplistic as it sounds, player driven, and I want them to set the template, and I'm just going to stand on the sidelines, and I might guide where appropriate, but I don't have too much knowledge of the game, then, you know, that's their business, and if they want to go about doing it in that manner, then you know, so be it. There's no law that suggests that they can't do that. And if they're involved with a club and the club allows them to do that, then, you know, great. That's on one end of a continuum of delivery, I suppose. And the other end of a continuum might be a professional academy. I recently listened to Chris Ramsey when he was at QPR. I think he's left there now, but when he was at QPR and he was talking about FIFO, fit in or F off, in terms of his coaches delivering in a certain style, which would be and a certain curriculum. And perhaps not a style, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but a certain curriculum and doing it in a certain way. And that was my understanding from what he was saying, that was the QPR way. So that might be on the other end of another continuum there. So you've got these two opposite things. I don't think there's necessarily one way to deliver on coaches. Where I stand with it is probably quite aligned with you. And I'm not just saying this because we're talking right now, but I think, coaching, I think, does involve domain expertise. Domain expertise is the technical tactical, especially the tactical side of the game, the principles of play, the language of the game, the specific behaviors related to the game and those principles, the tactical principles and responsibilities, the logic of the game, the rules of the game, all of these things exist. And ultimately, I think coaching does involve passing on knowledge of those things. That is my opinion. I'm also very conscious that some people might say, wear your expertise lightly and guide and, you know, allow the players to drive things.
Yeah.
I can see some sensibility in that built into a coaching program some of the time in order to build certain, you know, personal characteristics and certain enjoyment factors of being involved and leadership and teamwork and things like that. And being autonomy supportive for player involvement. And so there's that involvement is part of the building of the knowledge. But I would agree with you. I think coaching requires a certain degree of knowledge. I wouldn't go and be, I couldn't be a top class football coach because I just don't have the knowledge of the principles of play, the sessions that guide those principles of play, and so on and so forth. So we agree. What I would say, again, let's come back to this philosophy of and also either or. I have no problem that there are coaches out there who see it differently. I think it's an interesting conversation to have. And that's what it is, a conversation. But I think all these cultures, coaching cultures, need to exist in order for players to have options and choices and different experiences in the game. I kind of bemoan this notion on, you know, the classic thing on X, for example, formerly Twitter, where people go, it must be this way or it must be that way. Or, you know, they say, well, the so-and-so academy, the Chelsea academy, it's not player driven or it's like this or it's wrong. It's like, well, it's just, I think in any society, there's a, there's a multitude of offerings, and it's whatever suits the individual.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, and I completely get where you're coming from. I just you know, I guess the concern for me with a lot of this is that in the absence of that technical tactical grounding, if you like, does it leave too much room for coaches just to hide behind and this idea that we're just allowing the players to explore and express? And it's like, yeah, okay, cool. But at some point, you've got to be able to I guess measure it and manage it, right? In essence, and then I guess beyond that, then brings me back to the piece around being greedy. Well, how can you begin to be greedy about something that you don't know about if you don't know what's on the table? If you're right.
I think you can still be greedy in as much as if your lens of the world is, I want to, within my coaching practice, I want to give my players experience of leadership, teamwork, other psychological factors. I want to give them an opportunity to brainstorm their own solutions to these, to go away and bring their solutions to the table. Then that might be considered greedy, because there's a multitude of things that you can do within that coaching practice and that coaching culture. But again, as I don't disagree with you, mate, I have to be honest with you. You know, I have a golf coaching background, and I've listened to some people on some podcasts talk about engaging in golf coaching at a level one golf coaching standard, and it sounds like they haven't got a damn clue what they're talking about. They don't have any kind of lived experience. So I'm always very conscious of that. And I'm always very conscious of when I'm standing in a Premier League club and I'm sitting in a room full of people who are quite high profile in the game, you know, and there's little old me instructing things. You know, it's getting the balance between understanding what I do and do not understand within that environment from a football perspective. So look, I think it's interesting. I think you can still be greedy, but just greedy in a different way. And probably not greedy in line with how you see optimal coaching. And I think you have a fair and a good argument. You know, what is, if we're going to professionalize coaching, you know, should, if coaching in the future, and there's a lot of conversation about this, if coaching in the future goes down the pathway of sort of chartership status, is government regulated, for example? Because you know what, we want our young people and people in general to have the best possible experiences from coaches. Well, there has to be a standard of knowledge there, a degree and a level of knowledge that one can pass on to the people they're coaching. So I think it's a very fair point.
Yeah, no, and I totally appreciate that. And I said, listen, I want to take it back a couple of moments, because you know, you mentioned it effectively. I'm paraphrasing now, but people don't know what they don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Effectively, you know, you're limited to your knowledge and understanding of what you do know. So I guess, again, it's sparking some light bulbs to go off, and you know, it's making me think. Right. Well, what are some reflective actions then that coaches can start to take to start to explore those areas that they might not know about? What are some practices that you think that might be useful? Because that's fundamentally what it is, right? It's, you've got a way in which you work based on your lived experiences, as you put it, a way in which you work based on your lived experiences, what you've been exposed to maybe as a player, maybe in your experiences as a coach, working alongside other coaches and other people involved in that process. And I guess one of the biggest challenges, and this is, I think this is quite across the board, really, unless you're in a very, very collaborative and reflective kind of process, coaches are often left to their own devices and assumed as being quote-unquote the experts and never really challenged on it. And possibly someone like myself or someone like yourself roll in and think, are you sure about that? Maybe throw in a few considerations for them and think, actually, I'm not sure anymore. Because they don't often get those challenging, reflective questions to really consider and think deep around what it is they're doing and why they're doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course it does. It's making me think of several things, and I don't know if I'll cohesively put my ideas together here particularly well, but I'll try to. First and foremost, it's making me think of the importance of self skills. self-skills. And I might define self-skills, and I think this is mostly speaking to your question, but it probably brings in some other domains. But self-skills for me, in very simple terms, because I'm sure there's many, many self-skills that one can lay down and talk about. But for me, when I think of football, football coaching, any sports coaching, I think of self-awareness, self-control, self-reflection, and self-development. And I think they feed into each other. Self-awareness, self-control, self-reflection, and self-development. And it starts with that self-awareness piece, doesn't it? And you've asked, well, what are the channels of improvement here in terms of taking what you know and then developing on that? I think it starts with intellectualizing what you know. And as burdensome as it might sound, you know, it could be sitting there with a notebook and starting to lay out what you believe about your coaching. You know, what's important to you? What are your coaching beliefs? How do you want to go about this? And that might be, you know, that might be related to your coaching context. You know, so if you're a coach of under six, you know, what you lay out in your notepad might be different if you're a coach of under 12s, different to a coach of under 16s, a college coach or a professional coach in an academy or in a first team. So, of course, your coaching context might be considered king here. But then you might say, OK, well, what are my coaching beliefs around what my coaching context and maybe my coaching objectives for the coming year? And then you just lay out what you know, essentially, and what's important to you. And then I think you can start building upon that. And I think you do it in two ways. You do it in terms of continuing your reflections every single day on your coaching experiences, your coaching practice. But within your reflections, you know, you've got to ask yourself who, what, how, why, you know, who am I coaching? What was I trying to coach? How was I trying to coach them? This specific topic, if you like, why was I coaching them in this way? And then you can carry on with those questions. What were other ways I could have coached this? How might I have changed to these other ways? Why might I use a different way in the future? So for me, who, what, how, why are kind of questions you need to ask as you reflect upon your the session that you've just given. It requires constant reflection. So you can build your self-awareness around what works for you, what's strong, what's good within your coaching practice, within your coaching context, what you can improve upon. And I think the second branch there, again, you can write this in your little diary in your book, is just starting to explore research, explore books, explore different topics. And you can do that for as little as 5 minutes a day, even just getting some things down, just building your knowledge and starting to relate some of the things to some of the experiences you're having in your who, what, how, where, why, all of that jazz every single day within your reflection. And I think when you combine all of those, you can start to develop yourself, and it starts to be day on day, week on week, month on month, year on year reflection, or sorry, development, that enables you to then have over 5 or 10 years of improvement and development, rather than 5 or 10 years of the same year every single time. So really, and I'm slightly thinking on the go here, I think it's two strands. It's the self skills of self-awareness, self-control, self-reflection, self-development, and it's that reflective piece of reflecting what you're experiencing every single day, and, you know, related to the what, how, and why with relation to the who, and then it's your own research away from that on different topics that can get then filter into your daily reflections, of your experiences, that then builds a bit more of a broader and a deeper picture, going back to your coaching beliefs. Does that make sense? I need to write.
It definitely does. I think for me, it's a constant examination, right? Of like you said, who, what, why. And I think it reminds me of some recent conversations I've had with some coaches where I find it quite interesting. I don't know where I first started asking the question from or why, but effectively, I'm going through a range of different coach development courses at the moment. I'm supporting loads of different coaches, and it's actually quite interesting the amount of people that think they're doing the right things. And it's not to say they're not, but the question I've started asking a lot of people is, prove what you're doing is working.
Right.
Prove what you're doing is working, because I'm not sure if you can actually prove it, but how rigorous can you get in the objectification of what you're trying to do? How close can you get to that objective piece, right? Even little things like, this is an area for development for Dan. Prove it. Yeah, but I've seen Dan do this. Yeah, prove it. Where's your evidence to support that actually this is what Dan needs? And it wasn't that actually Dan needs this, but actually the opposition did something which exposed Dan. So it might not actually be a priority area for Dan, but in that moment, it was because of X, Y, Z in terms of what the opposition did, rather than this being a consistent need for Dan to have support on, if that makes sense. So I think, that's, and it's really started, it's sparked a lot of positive debates. Oh yeah, but how do I prove it? Well, if you can't prove it, then how do you know it's real? And it's just really challenging a lot of coaches around their perceptions. And it's got me thinking a lot more around, how do we get to a point where we can be greedy, but we're greedy about things we're conscious and we're actually rationalizing with, this is actually what we need to be greedy about rather than this is what we want to be greedy about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, look, several things to say. I mean, it sounds to me like you're engaging people in critical thinking, and critical thinking is important for judgment and decision-making. One could argue that the definition of coaching is it's a decision-making process to try to manage and change behaviours. So I think that's interesting, and I think that's great because you're... again, you're asking why, as you said. Maybe you can ask why 3, 4, 5 times. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you making that decision? Why are you having your players engage in this way? Why do you think what you're saying is true? I think even if one can't objectively measure something, these are valuable things to ask. And it does take people out of their comfort zone. And this exists, needs to exist at the very highest level of the game, because often it doesn't. And often at the very highest level of the game, there's still not everyone, I'm not saying that, but there's still an element of cut and paste, or copy and paste, from the history of the coach in question. They've seen it before, they've experienced it before, so they're going to do it again. Why are you doing what you're doing? It's a really, really important question to ask, and it makes people feel uncomfortable. I think, coming back to the greedy side of things, what you're posing is the importance of saying, well, yes, one can be greedy, but what are you going to be greedy about? Which I completely agree with. I think the greediness, whether it's the article, the short post I wrote, or just in general, it's an actual invite to broaden one's horizons. It's actually, because I just even think at the surface level, there's very many people out there who probably don't realize the existence of a lot of things that are possible. For instance, being able to develop psychosocial qualities in people, human beings, the people that they're coaching in sessions. The use of, I wrote about this all the time, the use of water breaks to consolidate memories of what they've just experienced. The use of the beginning couple of minutes to set the tone psychologically for the session, the use of the couple of minutes at the end to help develop teamwork, to get players talking together, the potential importance of huddles, in between activities or in the middle of activities to help players start to have conversations, and within that getting leaders within the team, if you want to call them that, to pick out other players to help them experience leadership and to draw them into the ability to communicate. I mean, even posted something today on the on how huddles can be, how leaders, how you can develop, excuse me, communication within leaders to help them be better within huddles before a game. You know, the reality is that very many people don't realize these things exist. And the existence of these things is to do with when you study a PhD, you go into the realms of ontological philosophy. Ontology is the meaning of things and the existence of things. Very many people don't think this exists. Very many people don't think that you can develop human beings' confidence. Very many people don't think you can help others to concentrate. Very many people don't realize you can actually develop the perceptual cognitive qualities of the individuals in front of you by simply directing their focus of attention. So I think my call for greediness is at the surface level and just saying, hey, these things exist out there, rather than dismissing them, which most people don't. But I, maybe sometimes I'm slightly guilty of using very long words, and I don't mean to, you know, I'm not certainly far from being a particularly intelligent person. I'm just a curious person. And when I engage in long words, for instance, some people throw back at me, oh, well, we've shut down immediately when you've used those words. And it's like, well, actually, if you spend 2 minutes to read what I've written, I've defined those words, and now you know those words and they make sense to you. So it's a call for open-mindedness in coaching. And then to your point, it's about, well, what specifically are you going to be greedy about within your coaching context, within your coaching practice? I think that that is a very important point you're making around being more specific. And that can be driven by judgment and decision making. Why are you judging this like this? And why are you making these decisions about you and your players? You have some critical reasoning here to what you're doing.
And I think that's the key, right? And that's really what I'm really, yeah, to use your words, inviting people to kind of explore is, well, what are we going to be greedy about?
Yeah.
Do you know what's on the menu?
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Before you've decided what dish you're going to eat,
yeah,
right? Rather than just going in there knowing exactly what you're going to order before the menu's even been given to you. And I think that's the piece I want coaches to get a bit more curious about, you know, in terms of that greediness piece, is because I actually love the concept of just be greedy, go for as much as you can, right? Because it takes you to my thoughts around, you know, the differences between maybe unopposed and opposed practice, if you like. And I often get critiqued because I I'm not saying it doesn't have a place, but the analogy I use is that I think unopposed practice is like moving at 10 miles an hour. Why would I want to move at 10 when I know I can move at 30 with opposed practice? It might be a bit bumpy. It might be a bit of, you know, it might be some turns and roundabouts in the way in the journey, but I'm still moving at 30 miles an hour is the way I put it. Now, that in itself is obviously challenging for a lot of people to kind of come to terms with that. That's an approach people take, because obviously the traditional is, well, let's start with technique. And I was, well, what is technique if as soon as Dan gets in the way of me and you passing that ball, we have to change the technique? Even if Dan's not in the way and we're passing the ball back and forth, well, guess what? We're never going to hit the ball same way twice in a row anyway. Mm-hmm. So what is technique if it's not just a structure of a movement pattern, if you like? And again, the structure of that movement pattern is fundamentally going to change every time I strike it, whether someone's in the way or not. So why not just put someone in the way and just deal with that instead, and learn how to kind of, like I said, drive at 30 miles an hour rather than 10 miles an hour on a clear road. But I guess to that, it comes back to the point I made earlier. Well, if you're going to go back to the piece of unopposed, I look at it from a standpoint of, well, you can coach the where, you can coach the why, you can coach the who, you can coach the what, you can coach the when. But actually, if you go to unopposed work, all you can really do is coach the how. So then it comes back to point number one. Well, you still need that foundation of technical and tactical knowledge of the game. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of that conundrum, because people want to start at that end of the spectrum in terms of traditional ways of working, if you like, but sometimes maybe don't have the grounding in terms of the technical information goes with it. And I often say, well, if you're coaching unopposed practice, one of two things is happening, in my opinion. You're either coaching the how, which is what it maybe should be there for, because you're trying to coach a technique, therefore you're trying to coach them the process of how to do something, or you're just simply stating the what's, in which case I'm saying, Dan, can you pass the ball from A to B? Or Dan, can you do this? Dan, can you? Yeah, but at some point you're going to have to go in there and show them something. And the only thing that you're left to do with, because there's no contextual interference, there's no variables in there, is the how. Whereas if you move to the game-like aspect of it, or more closer to kind of the game realism elements, you can start to coach the when, you can start to coach the why, you can start to coach the where, you can start to coach the what as an overarching thing beyond it, right? I'm just thinking out loud and my brain's kind of going in so many different directions. I don't know what your initial thoughts are on that.
My initial thought is to ask you the question, what kind of pushback do you tend to get when you introduce this topic to people? You initiate this debate about unopposed versus opposed. Why might somebody push back at you, or what are they saying?
Well, the argument is it's muscle memory. We need to teach him technique. And I'm saying, well, so I then do a bit of an open experiment, shall we say. I'll give you, I don't know, an item, a ball or a pen or something. I'm saying, okay, cool. Throw it in my direction and it will get to me. It might be a couple centimeters short, a couple centimeters long. It might get to me where you've intended to get to me. I said, all right, go and do it again. But I get other people to watch and observe this moment taking place, this interaction. And the first question I ask after the second or third time gone is, what did we notice? Because the point I'm making and trying to, I guess, highlight specifically is the technique changed. The technique has fundamentally changed because they've done an attempt, reflected, whether they're consciously aware that they've done a reflection or not, they've reflected on it, assessed it and said, oh, actually, that one fell about a foot short of where Dan is. So I'm going to throw it differently. Okay, cool. This one was a yard longer than where Dan was. Okay, so I'm going to throw it differently. All right, brilliant. So you've gone through three unopposed actions and yet you still change your technique. So what are you practicing? If it's not repetition of technique, then the challenge I put out there for people is, well, let's spend less time repeating solutions and more time repeating the experience of the problem. Because if we can help players identify the problems or how to identify a problem, they've got, in my opinion, the foundation of what they need to then go and identify some solutions for it. So I don't know if that answers your question or gives you the context that you were looking for in response.
And obviously I'm asking you some generic questions here, but you've provided them with a detailed response. Does that tend to change people's mind?
It does, in the sense that it makes them challenge their current thinking. But I think the thing that I've become very comfortable with as a process is within that is them not sure what to believe now, because you can kind of see their whole their trail of thought, their world has kind of just been blown apart. Oh my God, this is what we've been doing for the last 10 years. And it's just been blown apart in 30 seconds. Now, you get some people that are willing to die on their sword.
Yep.
You're going to get them. But I think the thing that I always kind of underpin it with, and I'll go back to, is my objective in the interactions is not to change your mind.
Okay.
My objective in these interactions is for you to be clear on why you're doing what you're doing. And in some cases, you may continue doing what you're doing, but you have a better understanding as to why you're doing it. And that's all I kind of underpin it with as a statement, if you like.
So what I'm hearing you say there is your line of questioning is striving to increase the volume of what we might in psychology call cognitive dissonance. A feeling of uncomfortable with relation to, say, let's say, one's thoughts or beliefs. And once you've turned up that volume of cognitive dissonance, once I feel a little bit uncomfortable with that, I start questioning that. I'm going through that uncomfortable stage of questioning. I'm asking myself why and what and how, and is this true? Is this belief true? And in many respects, that's your end goal. For you as a coach developer, it's to actually create that bit of cognitive dissonance to get the person to ask themselves serious questions about what they believe, about how they go about their coaching in this instance, opposed versus unopposed. And that's enough for you, because what you're doing is the end goal there is actually just getting them questioning it. And actually, that is what is an underpinning for professional judgment and decision making, which is what coaching is. Good coach development is having people ask themselves questions about what they're doing in order to aid them to come up with as clear a decision as they possibly can for their coaching. There's no right and wrong, essentially. There's just what, you know, they believe is best for them in their context, and that's what you're doing. That's what I'm hearing you're doing.
Yeah, and I guess the interesting part, and I'm thinking about this out loud, and is interesting that I've said to you, obviously, sometimes it might not mean that you do things differently, but you might just be more considerate and conscious of the fact that you're doing these things and you continue doing them, right? And I mean, I've been doing coach development for about 7-8 years now. And I remember when I first got into it, there'd be moments where I'd deliver on a course. I haven't seen the coach who was on that course for maybe like the best part of 6, 8, 9, 10 months or whatever. And I used to think it was so strange and so weird. That when I did eventually come back into contact with them, they would say something of or some version of, oh, yes, I'm still thinking about that thing you said. Or, yes, I'm never going to forget that thing you said. Or, yeah, or in some other ways, people would be like, oh, you know, I can't plan a session now without asking myself, what would yes say? Right. Which I'll be honest with you, I found it quite strange and I found it a bit weird. It's like, why are you still thinking about that? But then actually, you know, to come back to what you've just said, I later realized and reflected on it, I thought, actually, no, that's exactly what I want them to be doing. I need them to question and challenge themselves around why they're doing what they're doing, because that takes them closer to the other point I made earlier around prove it. Prove this is what your players need. And as long as, you know, it goes back into my philosophy around what coaches, in my opinion, should be doing with their players. If you can help your players better understand how to identify and sort problems, if you like, then you're giving them the platform, in my opinion, that they need to better come up with their own solutions. So if you actually want a player-centered, player-led and individualized and bespoke aspect to what you're doing, well, it's going to start by helping them understand the problems they're facing in the first place, because those problems and the way that they face them will encourage a more individualized and bespoke response to it. I don't know whether there's right or wrong or there, or whether that makes full sense, but yeah, I do feel strongly about that. And I guess to get to a point now where players that I'm constantly working with are just coming to expect, oh yeah, Yas is just going to ask us questions, so we're going to need to think whether we like it or not. It's just, you know, it's a great thing for me. And I think, you know, we do get closer to that point where we're trying to maybe identify and develop leaders, right? And self-regulators.
Sorry, was there a question?
No, I'm just thinking out loud, and I'm,
yeah. So, no, look, the way I would, in my own mind, intellectualize what you're saying is that there's actually decent science that underpins what you're saying, which is you're taking them through stages of change. You know, there's five stages of change. There's pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and then maintenance. Those are the five stages of change. You know, and pre-contemplation is before Yas has turned up to say anything and they're just coaching. Contemplation is when you turn up and you start asking those questions, you know, and you might even put some points to them. You might make some suggestions around, you know, your thoughts on opposed versus unopposed. And that is a big part of that contemplation stage. Just, you know, as long as they just don't brush it aside and walk away from it, you're getting them thinking. And that's where that meets with your experience of them coming back to you and saying, yeah, I'm still thinking about that. I'm still thinking. And that's how human beings work. It's very rarely does somebody, occasionally it can happen, but very rarely does somebody say, hey, you've changed my mind there. Yeah, I'm definitely going to go and do it like that. You know, not least because of who we are as human beings. We are trying to constantly protect our ideas, our values, our beliefs, and so on and so forth, because you know, that's a survival mechanism in and of itself. But once someone is given an opportunity to go away and really think things through and process it through their prior learning and their, you know, which is the filters of belief and the instructions and the experiences that they've had before, then they start to actually change and they start to take action on these things and change in accordance, or at least adjust slightly, you know. So absolutely. So I think there's good science to what you're saying. I'm trying to think, well, what you were saying to us, the latter part of that is that your it feels like your lens of football, you know, this team invasion sport, is that, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're looking at it through a perceptual cognitive lens, that that technique needs to be experienced predominantly through this perceptual cognitive lens of the problems being thrown at players. What are they seeing? What are they experiencing? And the technique they're going to choose to use, the appropriate technique for them, is based heavily on, you know, their perception of what's going on, kinematically, kinesthetically, haptically, with relation to their visual sense of what they're seeing, that kind of stuff. So
I would say so. I think, you know, it's interesting because the way in which you obviously worded it is probably bang on the money in terms of what I am going after. And I think I've recently started talking about this a lot, and about my I've developed a fascination with Bruce Lee. And there's a quote that Bruce Lee came out with, or it's a quote from Bruce Lee. It goes, "My technique is in response to your technique," and I think that sums it up perfectly, because there's so many things that go into that, in my opinion. It's not just looking at what the person's doing. It's looking at how they're doing it, in what way they're doing it, what's the purpose of why they're doing it. But then how does that interact with me as the individual on the other end of it? Because you could do the same thing to me and the person next to me, but we, as with different individual characteristics, are going to respond differently, because, you know, you might be quicker than me, but you might be slower than him. So it's my technique is in response to your technique, with a deeper understanding of not just what the opponent in this case is doing, but yourself is able to do. And then coupled that with the fact that, you know, that then transcends itself into the game itself and understanding that, well, we talk, you know, in football, they talk a lot about now about the six capabilities, one of them being deception. One of the core, you know, historical principles has been creativity. And I'm saying, well, it sometimes irks me and frustrates me a little bit when people say, yeah, I'm going to teach this player to be creative. You can't teach creativity, in my opinion. I think what you can teach is what my technique would expect to receive in response to your technique and vice versa. Therefore, anything that goes against the grain or the expectation is somewhat now arguably creativity, because it's gone against the expectation of what we're hoping to see or what we're going to see. So it's not the action in itself and doing something that's innovative to the point where you've never seen it before that makes it creative. It's creative because it's unexpected in the moment. At least that's how I would define it. In which case, takes me to the point of, well, the game in itself, because it's an invasion game, and you have to come back to that. And this is one of the biggest things I try and get coaches to really pick up and understand, is you have to go back to why the game is being played. Whether you want to accept it, agree with it, disagree with it, whatever you want, the game is an invasion game, which means your objective is to invade the opposition territory. In this game, it's by scoring a goal, or at the very least, getting into the space where you can do those things. Now, as that happens, doesn't matter what team you are, doesn't matter what league you play in, doesn't matter what country you're in. And we've seen it at the top level, even where you have teams that are maybe traditionally known for maintaining possession, building up play. Well, if the opposition press them high and the space in behind, guess what they're going to do? They're still going to put it in there, because that's where the opportunity is to penetrate and invade the opposition territory. So, again, I'm going off a bit of a tangent because I'm just just expanding my thoughts here. And I guess it comes back to that point, right? You have to have a base level and understanding of knowledge of the game from a technical tactical standpoint. And then couple that with knowing that there's probably some likely responses to what you do, and helping the players understand those problems, what the problem is, helping them unpack what the opportunities might be for them, almost doing a SWOT analysis, right, with the players to help them understand, well, this is what the opposition might do or might not do, or in coaching language, coaching the what and then the what if. You start to unpack and understand, actually, these actions and these moments of the game can look very different, but there is a kind of a base level of what it looks like, and the game just gets recycled in many moments. So I guess my question to you off the back of that would be, what are your thoughts in terms of how you begin to encourage players to identify the problems, and maybe something for coaches to consider around, yeah, actually, maybe we might need, even if you agree with it at all in any way, shape or form, that we do need to maybe help players become better at identifying the problem before providing a solution, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. I think just the challenge that sometimes comes with it is coaches are quick to provide a solution the players don't yet know the problem for.
Okay. What I'm hearing you say, you have an interesting philosophy, because you seem to, probably a bit like me, juxtapose what some skill acquisition experts might call ecological dynamics with information processing. It's kind of interesting listening to you, because again, I think we think quite alike, and I'm not a football coach, let me be clear, but I am invested and interested in skill acquisition, coaching science, and so on and so forth with relation to sports psychology. And I'm a greedy sports psychologist in as much as I'm interested in learning and how human beings learn. And I don't think sports psychology is just about mental health and well-being, which tends to be a bit of the narrative these days. What I'm hearing you say is your skepticism around the repetition of unopposed practice. Your skepticism revolves around this idea of a central motor program. Yeah, I'm bastardizing the research literature a little bit. It's the research, I believe, of Schmidt. You're questioning that, and you're really into adaptability, technical adaptability, to be able to adapt one's own motor skill, motor coordination in the moment based on what one sees. And that's actually quite aligned with maybe where ecological dynamicists are, and the at the coalface, the ecological dynamicists, session designers around constraints led, there's a constraints led approach, because they're saying there's not one way to execute a technique, and it's more non-linear. We're setting down problems, constraints, if you like, and affordances, and so technique comes, emerges as a consequence of those constraints and those affordances. Anyway, that's getting into the jargon, but that's interesting in and of itself. That feels like, even though you might not describe it that way, you're not saying there's one. People use this term, and you mentioned it earlier, muscle memory, and that's a misnomer. Muscles don't have memories, but there's the debate between a central motor program, if you like, and a skill as adaptiveness. So there's that. And at the same time, you're talking about the importance of engaging in session design, whereby you're laying down problems for players to solve. And by doing so, you're giving them experiences of solving those problems. You're getting them to see lots of situations, to experience solving those situations. And by doing so, they start to recognize those situations in games in the future, in training in the future. And so available to them are, you know, they will process that, and very quickly available to them would be the solutions will pop up in their mind. And that is what we might call intuition. You know, people use this term instinctive, and instinctive, this is where people get this wrong, actually. Instinct is the digestive system. Instinct is your heartbeat. Instinct is breathing. It's intuition happens very, very quickly in the moment. A striker scores on intuition. He sees the space intuitively and scores that way. So what it sounds to me is you're trying to create session designs that pose problems that players have to solve. And the more that they see, and the more that they process in those session designs, in those activities, then by paying attention to those, they available to them in future games, that information, they've seen it before, they can do it. So to speak to your question, I would, by and large, agree with you. I would say that most session design, if somebody asked me, I would say session design would ideally mostly revolve around problems that players have to find solutions to. So there's an element of autonomy support. If they've got to find a solution, rather than me giving them the solutions, it might be that within the education process that I do give them some solutions, or I do teach them a specific set of behaviors related to principles. And so I would be inclined to mesh the two together, that I think both can exist, that I think that I can provide language, I can shared language, especially I can provide some solutions, but I can also create designs where players have to find their own solutions or use what I've taught them in the past. So I do think both, because I think principles exist, and I think that, you know, width, depth, all that kind of jazz stuff that you know much more about than I do, mate. I think that is science. And so there are ways to exploit principles. And maybe that's where it comes back to, we have to have a knowledge of these. We have to teach these on the tactical side of the game.
Yeah.
And we have to introduce activities that provide players, that test players' ability to utilize what we've taught them, and also intuitively find their own solutions. And I think to speak to your question, to answer your question, then it becomes, coaching becomes a game of directing attention. and questioning attention, yeah. having that external focus of attention that demands players pick up on the cues, clues, and triggers that are out in the environment that they can then act upon. So it's kind of, again, to use the intellectual modern day academic jargon, it's kind of a fusion between ecological dynamics, ecological being information is out there, and information processing as in we've processed this before, and it's the interplay between the two. So knowledge is knowledge about the game, principles of play, knowledge of the game, well, how am I exploiting these, and knowledge in the game is the ever-evolving, emerging and dissolving of information that's going on around us. Does any of that ramble make sense?
Yeah, it's quite close. I think the only thing I would maybe slightly clarify on that is it's less about providing the environment for them to solve problems,
mm-hmm.
and more probably about leading and with them, supporting them in understanding and unpacking what the problem is.
Okay.
So rather than me saying, right, I'm going to go out and set some problems for them to solve, if that makes sense.
Yep.
It's, I may do that, but less explicitly, with more of an explicit lens and a focus on, right, what are you noticing? So it's really about what you're noticing for me.
Yep.
Because fundamentally, from my perspective, it's more, well, this is a problem I might set for you, but how have you perceived it? Because it's, and then it kind of, you know, I've started using this phrase quite a lot as a result of lining into this philosophy is, as a coach, are we observing the game through our eyes or their experience?
Yep.
In which case, we might see things from the side, we might not see things from the side, but it's not about what we see, and it's about how they feel in it. And most importantly, it's kind of reframing that perception of, as an example, what pressure might be. Well, if I've got 2 yards of space in front of me and I've got an open shot that I can take potentially with 2 yards of space, I might not feel pressure. I might not feel pressure until the defender's literally shirt tight. But to someone else who's experiencing it from an observation, they might have deemed that as pressure. So it's again, going back to that phrase, well, we've got to be careful on how we perceive things, but also linking into something else you said, that, you know, it can be directed, it can be a merge of giving them solutions, can be a merge of helping them understand the problem, which I fundamentally agree with. But then takes me back to my earlier point and the challenge that I put on a lot of coaches maybe listening to this, if they are. No one's saying you have to have the way, but in my opinion, you have to have a way. A way that you can fall back on as a coach to help the players understand the how behind what it is you're asking them to do. And not just a case of me giving you a bunch of what to say, go after them. You know, how challenge the challenge for coaches, maybe from my perspective listening to this, is how well do you know what you know, and how well are you able to then break that down and articulate that as a recipe for a process, if you like, rather than just giving the people the ingredients and saying, here's the ingredients, off you go. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. And I like what you're saying. And my understanding of what you're saying, again, without repeating both yourself and myself, is you're laying down problems in your activities. That's your session design. And the questions you're posing is, perhaps you're asking players to find solutions to these problems, but you're predominantly asking them, what problems have you set? What's their perception of the problem that you've set? And so you're trying to both understand their lens of that world, and then, you know, ask them questions probably around that. And what I'm hearing you say, sort of full circle back round to the beginning, where you pose this idea of, well, great coaches need to have a real strong technical tactical knowledge, you know, with that in mind, then I absolutely agree with you, because you've got to have a strong knowledge of principles of play, the logic of the game, the behaviors partial to the game, you know, with relation to it being an invasion sport, and so on and so forth, you know, because it's all on your session design. And then within your coach behaviors, it's the questioning and the suggestions and the prompts. You know, there's going to be you're going to pose questions, but you're going to have some, you're personally going to have some answers to those questions, but you do want to hear what the players have got to say. You're getting them thinking, and I like it, because that's really what I think great coaching is. It's getting players thinking about the problems that have been delivered to them. So I like it. I like it.
Dan, it's been a pleasure. So I guess I'm gonna finish off with this final question for you then.
Okay.
If there was one thing that you, off the back of the kind of conversation that we've had today, that you want coaches to go away and challenge themselves to try and implement, what would that be?
Oh, dude, there's so many things.
What would you say are the most notable ones?
I think if I, so much of what we're talking about here, dare I say it, because I have constant debates with ecological dynamicists, and they're so insistent on an external focus of attention. And that could be the problem when you constantly instruct players what to do, is you're internalizing things for them. But I would say the listening to what you're saying and how you go about things, you're asking players to have that external focus of attention, to see what's out there. I think if coaches can help players orient their attention externally, and I know for the most part they do, but really do that purposefully and instrumentally by asking questions, and by posing those questions through the kind of session design that you're talking about, setting the problems and asking about what problems that you're setting, I think ultimately it comes, what you're doing is you're externalizing focus of attention, and you're trying to tap meaning. You're trying to help players create meaning of what around what they're seeing. So I think I would ask coaches, with relation to our conversation, and very much in line with how you like to coach, because you're the football coach here, not me, you're the expert, not me, I think it's consider players' focus of attention, internal, external, broad, narrow. Can you externalize it, and can you help them develop meaning with relation to what they're seeing, with relation to the game? That's what I'd say.
Lovely. I think that's a great way to put it. And I think it is just, again, having that challenge, right? And just And I think you've put it there beautifully, in the way that I probably wouldn't have put it myself, in that it is about helping the players find meaning around what they're doing and why they're doing it. Because those are the things that, you know, in my opinion, help them really absorb and attach themselves to the learnings of each moment they're in. But I'm sure that's a conversation for another day as well. There's so many different, you know, different ways in which you can go. But Dan, I'm conscious of time. I want to say massive thank you for obviously being on with me and having another conversation with me on the show. But just a final one before we do boot off. And obviously you've got your podcast. I don't know if you want to give people a bit of a quick insight around where they can find that, and any other pieces that you want to share.
Please. Yeah. Thank you so much, mate. It's the Sports Site Show is the podcast. We do deep dives around everything sports psychology, broad definition of sports psychology, so SKILAC and skills, science of coaching, and so has some really great conversations there. My website is danabrahams.com. You can find me on social media, especially at danabrahams77, and LinkedIn, Dan Abrahams, Facebook at Dan Abrahams Soccer, where I'm writing every single day. So please do follow me, and I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
Amazing. Dan, thank you very much for your time again. Guys, make sure you check out Dan and his podcast again, and you know, follow his post on LinkedIn as well. Really good stuff. Cheers for that, Dan.
Thanks, mate.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at The Coaches Network or on Twitter at The Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.